OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Now, you're very welcome along to the football show. Later on, we'll be checking in with Nathan Murphy, a few bits and pieces going on. But we want to start with the 35th anniversary now of the Bradford City fire at Valley Parade. Without question, one of the most tragic instances in sport that we've ever seen, and without question in English football. To discuss, Daniel Taylor has done a lot of work on this story of The Athletic, formerly of The Guardian. Daniel, you're there. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Nice to be here.
Great to talk to you. So let's pick our way through this. I think the vast majority of the audience listening will be vaguely aware of the details. They may be unaware of some of the specifics, and more still, maybe unaware of some of the more disturbing aspects of this story, which have emerged in the last 5 years or so. Let's start with the day itself. 35 years on, this was May the 11th, 1985. It was the final game of the third division season. It resulted ultimately in the deaths of 56 fans, many more badly injured, badly burnt. It was a day which started with a celebration. It was the home team receiving the Football League third division trophy.
Yeah, that's right. It was, as you say, it was a celebration. They just won the league. They were going up to the old second division for the first time in around 50 years. The place, you know, it was a sellout crowd, and they were playing Lincoln City, and it was the last day of the season. And basically, I mean, there was nothing really riding on the game other than a kind of a bit of a party atmosphere, I suppose. You know, they collected the trophy beforehand, and yeah, it was a great occasion for a club that had been been in the doldrums for decades basically. So then what happened then was, just before half time, the basically just a thin line of white smoke just started coming through the floorboards at the back of an old wooden stand, and I wouldn't really recommend watching the video, but you know, which is on sort of online, you can see it, but it's not exactly, it's quite chilling to see, you know, and basically within a couple of minutes, this sort of what started off as, you know, just a thin line of white smoke had basically turned into an inferno that had taken up the whole stand. And a lot of the fans had to run for their lives, basically, and 56 people were killed at the back of that stand because the doors were locked at the back of the stand, and they ran to the back to try and get out, and there was no way out, basically. There were several hundred injured and burnt, and it's just, you know, I'm obviously very aware of the story and the TV pictures and the commentary you can hear. It's, you know, it's horrific sort of stuff. You know, everyone else runs to the front of the stand and gets out by kind of jumping over a wall at the front of the stand to get onto the pitch, and obviously none of the fans know. I mean, it's bizarre, really. You look at the pictures and there's sort of fans jumping around on the pitch sort of singing songs, and obviously just don't realise the gravity of what's actually happening, you know, but essentially the ground is a fireball, you know, and the speed of the fire is now, what happened at Bradford is now used in disaster lectures and fire training from the fire service, just to show the speed that fire can travel, because it truly is remarkable how quickly, you know, it just goes from a line of smoke into something, you know, sort of devastating.
We're talking on the radio here. We're also going out on social media. We've just put up a still of the inferno, as you rightly describe it.
Yeah.
And it's hard to overstate the speed with which it went from just a puff of smoke into the inferno that we've just seen on our screens there, where the whole thing is engulfed. The reasons for this are varied. So there was, and we will get in more to how this started a bit later on, but certainly we know, and it is uncontested information, that rubbish stored for years, maybe even decades, beneath the stand, in that cavity beneath the stand, made for absolutely perfect, and that's the wrong choice of words, but perfect kindling. We're talking here about a wooden stand, and we're also talking about a highly flammable roof. So once this thing started, it almost combusted.
Yeah, that's right. And that is uncontested. You know, there was, I'm amazed they survived the but in the sort of debris, they found fragments of a newspaper, and they could see the date on the newspaper, and it was 1968. And they, they found rubbish that, beneath the stand, and you could sort of like sweet wrappers and stuff that had kind of like the old currency on it. So you know, it wasn't even how we would see it now. You know, it wasn't sort of like, you know, it was like I can't remember exactly what it was. You know, in shillings and sixpences, and you know, so really, really old. You know, there'd been a, I wouldn't describe it as a mountain of rubbish, perhaps, but you know, certainly a large buildup of rubbish that had been under that stand, which you know, dropped through the sort of floorboards and you know, had built up for a long, long time. And again, uncontested. Again, Bradford had received warnings about this, basically saying, in effect, that this was a fire hazard and that something should be done about it. And as we all know, in the 1980s sort of football culture, things weren't done, and basically these warnings were not heeded. And basically, you know, in tragic consequences, but you know, what happened could really have been avoided. You know, that's one of the things that I've always felt about Bradford, that it was a terrible, terrible tragedy, but it was also a national scandal, really, what happened there.
Yes, there were certainly at least three separate warnings about the potential fire risk, and they were ignored clearly. You mentioned that one of the main reasons people did lose their lives, the turnstiles at the back of the stand were locked. Now, luckily, and there's not much luck with this story, but a semblance of luck, unlike at Hillsborough where fans were penned in, and we know about the consequences of that, fans weren't penned in here pitch side. So, and we've seen a few photos there, it allowed a huge number of people to escape onto the pitch, and they had ease of access to run onto the pitch. So that was one of the small graces in this story.
Yeah. Well, can you imagine what the death toll would have been if they had had fences at the front of the stand? You know, I mean, it was already difficult for some of the people to get out of the front because the wall at the front was 8 feet high. And, you know, a lot of the people in that stand were elderly. You know, a lot of the dead were either young or elderly. It was hard to get out anyway in that pandemonium that ensued. But can the death toll would have been unimaginable if there'd been fences at the front, which would have made it very, very hard to get out. You know, incredibly hard to get out of. And I also think, after Bradford, it's when I mentioned earlier about it being a national scandal, you know, it's just it's incredible, really, that they had what passed as an inquiry into Bradford, yet it was never, you know, one of the things that never came out of it was about the perils of having. It's inconceivable to me that basically after the fire of Bradford, that there were cages and fences anywhere in football, because obviously of the what we'd seen in 1985, but obviously it's only 4 years later that we saw Hillsborough, where you know the fences were caused all those deaths. You know, I find it remarkable, really, that any football club after Bradford, you know, that inquiry in my mind should really have looked at the safety of football stadia and made the pretty obvious point that if there had been safety fences at, well, when I say safety fences, if there had been fences at Bradford, it would have been, I mean, 56 people died in this tragedy, and hundreds were burnt and badly injured, but the death toll would have been far, far higher if they'd been trapped in.
Thousands. I think there were 18,000 in that stand. I mean, it really could have been at least half of them, if not more.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, with no exaggeration whatsoever.
So the Popwell inquiry you mentioned there, this is an inquiry. It's led by now Sir Oliver Popwell a couple of weeks after the fire. It lasts certainly less than 10 days. It's a quick inquiry. So one...
It lasted 5 days.
5 days, okay.
I mean, if you can... I realise times have changed, but it does seem remarkable that A, it was held so quickly after the... I mean, it was held so quickly that there were still people who should have been giving evidence in hospital or burying their loved ones, you know, so, yeah. Or just not in a, you know, in a state where they were able to sort of take part in it. You know, there was a constant decision to kind of do it and do it very quickly. Popplewell said before the inquiry started that he wasn't trying to apportion blame. So the inquiry happened. It happened very quickly, and they decided that the most likely cause was that someone had maybe dropped a lit cigarette or a match through one of the gaps in the floorboards, and that kind of lit the rubbish beneath the stand. I'm certainly not the only person that thinks that. When I was working for The Guardian, we did a story. We found we were shown some documents from West Yorkshire Police who described the inquiry as a seat of the pants affair. Mm. There've been politicians here who've basically questioned now years on why it was held so quickly and whether it was possible in that time. I mean, if you look at the amount of time, for example, that was devoted, and justifiably so, to the Hillsborough inquests, the inquiry and the inquests here into Bradford were just a fraction. I mean, I think the Hillsborough inquest, off the top of my head, was something like eight or 9 months. Forgive me if I'm wrong there, but it was certainly a long, long time, and whereas. Bradford was just sort of very much rushed through.
I'm going to bring in the Fletcher family in a moment. Just one other point to make. So this Popplewell inquiry happens. It's a very brief affair. They conclude cigarette or pipe tobacco slipped through the gaps in the floorboards. Unfortunately, there was all this litter of 20 years there, potentially, and the whole thing just zoom goes up.
Yeah.
About 5 years ago, Detective Inspector Raymond Falconer, this was on the back of the 30th anniversary of the fire, and he had, been talking about this version of events, and a couple of news organisations named the man, supposedly with the cigarette, as an Eric Bennett, and he was visiting his nephew in Bradford. He was from Australia, he was at the game that day. And so following these reports, the nephew of that man, Eric Bennett, Leslie Brownlee, is reported to have said that his uncle never made an admission of this. So it was reported that the uncle had admitted this, and his nephew says, "I don't believe the statement of the retired detective at all. I don't know where he's getting this cock and bull story from, the inaccuracies in this report, but it's dumbfounding." So that is not to say someone else didn't drop a cigarette through the floorboards, but certainly the Australian man who was named, his nephew denies that.
He was named by Raymond Faulkner, who was used by the BBC and he was a detective in the West Yorkshire Police. I'd have to phrase this very carefully, but maybe if your listeners kind of Googled Raymond Faulkner, they'd find out that maybe his time in the police didn't end so well, and there's a lot of. I'm not sure he was on the Bradford case when it was said that he was on the Bradford case, and why he would make these statements, which, he's made some very strong statements, which certainly is contradicted by a lot of information out there.
Okay.
So it's kind of muddled an already complicated situation, his involvement. This probably goes back to what we were just saying a few minutes ago, that if there'd been a longer and more fulfilling inquiry that there's so many unanswered questions and things that have come out subsequently that basically were never really dealt with at the time. And this isn't just me speaking. I interviewed recently Tony Della Hunter, who was the radio commentator on the day. But he was more than just the kind of local radio guy. He'd led the sort of Save Bradford City appeal that had been in place because they had a lot of financial hardship before the takeover that led to the owners that were there for the fire. So he was a really kind of important figure at the club, and he all these years on very very well, yeah, angry, I suppose, that he felt there was no real appetite to investigate the fire properly, and that everyone just wanted to the blanket of praise that basically people, you know, always talked about how stoic and strong the people of Bradford were and how they all rallied together. But he said that it was almost like that was used as a blanket almost to cover up the truth, that people didn't really want to kind of like go investigating and trying to find out what the hell happened there.
Yeah.
So it probably just goes back a little bit to the fact that, you know, there was a very, very quick inquiry. There was an inquest, which the coroner has now said that he basically felt hamstrung and he had to go with the same verdict as Popplewell's inquiry, which is, you know, because of political interference, which doesn't sound great either. Mm. So it just, you know, there's just a lot of, I think things, it would be handled very, very differently these days. You know, I mean, look at Grenfell, you know, I mean, that's been, there's a lot of questions about Grenfell and the way that's been done. But it certainly wouldn't have been rushed through within a few days.
And we may have left it at that. We may have always remembered this as tragic accident. Maybe we don't know precisely how the fire started, but tragic accident up until maybe about 5 years ago. And that's where we bring in the Fletcher family. Now, to really give people a sense of tragedy, Martin Fletcher is the man at the centre of his own inquiry, effectively. And the Fletcher family went to that game en masse. So Martin Fletcher, still alive today, in his 30s. His brother Andrew, aged 11 on the day, was the youngest victim. Their father, John...
Martin's 47 now, because Martin was 12 on the day.
Okay, their father, John, who is just 34. You know, we're talking about a young dad here. So Andrew, aged 11, the youngest victim. Their father, John, aged 34, dies as well. Their uncle, Peter, John's brother, dies as well, aged 32. And their grandfather, Eddie, aged 63, dies as well. So three generations, and Martin survives. Tell us about what he did. He obviously suspected, or if he didn't suspect, certainly he wanted more concrete answers as to what happened. So he started digging into this story, and all of this came to fruition about 5 years ago. Tell us what he found. Tell us about how he went about things, Dan.
Well, Martin, I should probably just say as well, I was in
school.
Martin's class at school.
Yeah.
So basically, this is probably why I've obviously always had such a strong interest in it, because I can remember Martin coming to school a few weeks later, and I didn't really know him then. You know, we were in the first year of big school, and basically, I can just, you know, I remember hearing something bad had happened, and we weren't to talk to him about it, and he turned up, and he had blisters. His ears were sort of red raw, and his sort of hair was still charred. But I just didn't get, you know, I was 11 years old. I just didn't get it, to be honest. You know, I didn't really understand it, but Martin, Martin's just been through like the most horrific experience you could ever imagine, really. And credit to him that, you know, he's an incredibly intelligent guy. He's made a career for himself in London, and basically he's a very kind of rounded person, you know, after everything he's been through. But he basically gave up his career for a couple of years to write a book, which was basically, he devoted his life to kind of looking into Bradford more in depth. And basically he and his mother, Susan, had all sorts of questions that they felt were never answered properly. Susan had basically taken Bradford to court in a civil case, and Bradford were found, and this is very important, Bradford were found 2/3 responsible for the events leading to the fire because of negligence. So Bradford, you know, it's out there, it's not contested. Bradford, you know, it was found in a court to be 2/3 Bradford's fault, the other third being the county council, who were responsible for the fire matters. Martin brought out a book, and I suppose the headline, the thing that basically grabbed people's attention and certainly appeared in the media a lot, was that basically he revealed in this book that Stafford Heggenbottom, the chairman of the football club at that time, had, I think it was at least 9 businesses where there'd been fires at his businesses. Now, obviously, that's a kind of a bit of an incredible revelation because, I mean, I don't know about you, but do you know anyone that's had even two fires, never mind nine? I think it was put as at least nine. And so he did detail where these fires were, and Stafford Higginbotham is he died quite a long time ago now, so unfortunately, you know, he's not around to kind of to give his side, but obviously this did create a bit of a should we be looking at this again and in a lot more detail, which certainly I would support. That actually hasn't really happened, but there's again, speaking to people like Tony Del Hunte, I went to the coroner. The coroner who backed Martin's book, Tony Del Hunte backed Martin's book. It hasn't really kind of nothing really seems to have happened from it really that I've seen in the last few years. It's created a kind of a split in Bradford, because a lot of people in Bradford, they don't want to believe, and I do understand this, right? They've been told for years and years and years that it's a tragic accident. And it's quite hard, I think, for someone to come along many years later, even someone with Martin Fletcher's backstory, and basically say, I think we should look at this a bit, you know, I think we should scrutinise this more in depth, and that there are things that we should talk about rather than just kind of glossing over. But a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people don't like these, don't like the fact it's even been brought up, because obviously, as you can imagine, in the city of Bradford, it's a very, very emotive subject.
Yeah, and the implication is horrifying, clearly. I mean, it's a chilling thought. I remember reading that piece, actually. I remember reading that piece in The Guardian a couple of years ago. I remember you had interviewed Martin Fletcher and you talked about how you knew the family. And I remember vividly reading Stafford Higginbotham, nine fires at businesses owned or associated with him, the first of which was a factory in May 1967. And here we are in May 1985. Now, he died in 1995, aged 61. The other implication is that there was financial difficulty. Is that part of the story here? And do we know, Dan, because this was contested by Higginbotham's son, to what extent was there an insurance payout on the back of the fire?
Well, these are the part, you know, I have to be slightly careful because I don't want to, it kind of comes back to a little bit, I just wish there was some kind of official process that could have, you know, where we could say these things that are not contested, because that obviously makes things a lot easier for me. But yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Bradford were in massive financial difficulties, as a lot of football clubs were in those days, and that basically they, you know, I'm trying to word this carefully, but you know, a lot of money was raised for the new stand, and there are many people who think, you know, fair enough, you know, these are all, Martin's book is incredibly well sourced, and basically this should be investigated. Whereas there are other people who don't like the allegations. You know, as I say, Stafford Higginbotham he certainly wasn't chased out of Yorkshire, and nor were his colleagues. I mean, Bradford City has an award-winning fanzine, which has a kind of cartoon caricature of Stafford Higginbotham on the front of it on every edition. You know, as I said, I'm not criticising the fanzine as such, but just gives you a little flavour of the mixed views that Martin's investigation sort of encountered when it all came out in the public. And, you know, Stafford Higginbotham clearly has supporters within Bradford. I find all that very, very strange, bearing in mind the death toll when we know, because the court has proven this, there was negligence and it was on his watch. So I find all that part of it very strange. And, you know, Martin has encountered hostility. The local paper in Bradford has been very hostile towards him for, I think, political reasons. But whereas elsewhere, I hope not that your listeners are listening to this thinking, well, you know, this sounds like the sort of stuff that really should have been investigated at the time, you know, proper investigation.
Yeah. I know it was put to, we mentioned the Popwell inquiry, that was the one that happened a few weeks after the event, And this new information was put to him, and he agreed that the history of fires surrounding Stafford Higginbotham's other businesses was, to use his phrase, highly suspicious. Now, he did defend his own inquiry, and he did say that he felt a new inquiry, regardless of how long it might go on, would emerge with the same finding that he did in 1985. I just have a quote from Higginbotham's son, Simon. You know,
yeah,
the allegations are so serious, and I'm sure the Higginbotham family want their side put forward. So his son made the point that, for a start, Higginbotham's two sons, i.e. I'm including Simon in this, his two sons and his wife, their mother was in the stand. So he said, "We're disgusted." He said his brother was at a certain point in the stand, and he said, "Myself and my mother were both in the middle of the stand that day. Why is my father going to light a fire on a day like that with all his family sat in the stadium?" Which is a question really of significant merit. Now, neither of us can answer it. We're not in anyone's heads, but it is a significant question that would strike me as valid. And equally, he said,
I agree. Yeah. I just say it's a difficult one for me to answer that. But I kind of wish that people in better positions had thought it was worth looking at. And I mean, there was a quote from Martin's mother in the book where she said that, you know, she lived in the city, and that it was well known that, you know, when Higginbotham had a problem, it went up in flames, basically. Now, I've heard other people in positions of authority saying similar. Yeah. So Stafford Higginbotham's reputation locally was known for this. Yeah. So it just strikes me as, again, you know, I certainly am not pointing fingers here. What I'm saying is that you can understand very much why Martin's family and people that have read Martin's book and you know, you can very much understand why they think that this should have been or should be looked at, and that it shouldn't really have been for Martin Fletcher, you know, a boy who's, you know, 30 to 35 years on, launching his own investigation because he feels that the proper authorities at the time just sort of skipped over it, and you know, it was all a bit of a whitewash in his mind. So yeah, that's really the crux of it. That basically, you know, we should have these answers rather than sort of talking about what appeared in a book three sure. decades later.
The line is misbehaving a touch, but there is just one other point from Simon.
Yes.
No, you're okay, Simon Higginbotham, to put out there, because I wasn't clear on this. He said the stadium was going to be pulled down that summer, which, as I understand it, was. They were going to build a non-wooden stand. He said, "Why would you burn down a club that had been deemed uninsurable and of no use for any insurance claim?" Is he right in saying that? It wasn't insured, the stand, or it was? I can't quite make it. I know you said money was raised for a new stand, but what was there an insurance claim?
You're going to have to slightly forgive me here, because this was 5 years ago when Martin's book came out.
Sure.
So I the nitty gritty of what was insured and what wasn't. I know Martin Fletcher's book was incredibly well researched, yeah. And there's not a point of it that he doesn't clarify. You know, it's so. But you'll have to forgive me there, because I must admit, just in terms of the nitty gritty of the dates of the insurance, and you know, Martin has certainly always told me that basically, you know, a lot of money came back to Bradford from that.
Right.
Now, the one thing I would also say is that Martin sets this out in his book, but it has become sort of widely seen as him basically saying Stafford Higginbotham committed this fire. He never ever uses that kind. He basically kind of almost lets the readers decide or make their own minds up about whether it should be warrant for investigation. You know, so, you know, my personal view is that, as I said earlier, you know, I don't know anyone that's had two fires, never mind nine. And you know, there's parts of the story that certainly don't sit right.
Yes, I think that is a fair statement. I am amazed, actually, in the last 5 years since this new information came to light about Higginbotham's businesses and the other fires, that another investigation hasn't happened. Do we know why it hasn't happened? Do we know who should have been conducting an investigation like this? Is it something the FA should be taking charge of? Is it something the police authorities should be leading? Who are we looking to here, Daniel, as the appropriate authority to certainly reinitiate something?
Well, Martin's been contacted by various lawyers, and they're strangely never really. I think this is strange anyway, and maybe, you know, hands up, I've got a personal involvement because I know Martin. I've always been amazed, and I was just amazed that there was never the momentum behind this. It was a big story,
yeah,
in 5 years ago when it came out, but there was never it needed the momentum, I thought, of the government getting behind it, or I don't know, West Yorkshire Police, sort of, you know, a new. It needed someone to basically kind of say this isn't good, you know. So people, you know, there were lots of politicians talking about it and saying, you know, oh, this, but nobody ever actually did anything about it. If you know what I mean? So it kind of just, you know, people recognised it as a big story, and you know, all that, you know, that looks suspicious, and that, you know, a lot of people felt it was worthy of more investigation, but it just never got the momentum behind it from the people with the power to kind of make the difference. If you know what I mean? So. You know, and also, as I say, it's a bit different to say the Hillsborough campaign, because there's just a kind of different mentality where, you know, Martin has, I mean, don't get me wrong, he's certainly got many supporters and people backing him, and people, you know, huge number of people have been in touch with him. But equally, he hasn't got the city of Bradford behind him. You know, it's very divided. There's a lot of Bradford fans who would rather not go there, put it that way. And so there's just not been any kind of like momentum within the city itself. Martin's left Bradford now. You know, he doesn't live in the city. The local paper has not supported him. The local paper's attacked him, basically. I think that's a scandal in itself, to be honest, but that's another issue. So it just hasn't gone. It hasn't sort of moved forward in, you know, so these questions that I say are unanswered. You know, I'm not sure when or if ever they will be answered. That's something that I find very unsatisfactory.
Okay. Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for your time and explaining all that to us.
No problem. Sorry about the bad phone line. No, thanks for having me on.
Not at all. Daniel Taylor there from The Athletic. We'll take a short break. Now, you're welcome, Mark. So thanks again to Daniel Taylor for being with us. We'll podcast that full conversation, and you can do plenty of reading on it. Daniel has written about it in The Athletic and The Guardian down the years, and it doesn't seem like much has come of it. But we'll park that there for the time being. Something completely different. Nathan Murphy, hello to you.
How are you?
Very well. Oh, Serge Aurier. I mean, there's a lot of contenders for which footballers had the worst COVID crisis. But, I mean, Serge Aurier is right up there. I mean, he broke lockdown for a third time. The man just can't stop breaking lockdown. Does he know lockdown is on?
Well, does anybody at Tottenham know lockdown is on? Because they've been serial offenders in this, and meeting up in parks and individual training sessions. In a way, maybe we shouldn't be surprised, because there's one thing we've learned from watching Serge Aurier on the pitch. It's that he doesn't learn his lesson. How many times is he given the exact same penalty kick away where a forward inside the area just sticks their leg around in front of him and he kicks the back of their ankle again and again and again? But, yeah, it's kind of gone beyond a joke at this stage. Yeah. Tottenham are going to do an investigation. You would think, again, Premier League clubs would realise their position within society and come down quite hard. Mm. But maybe, again, we should have more sympathy with young men who may well be living alone in a foreign country, and life is quite difficult for them, that they haven't seen anybody for weeks on end, that it's not as straightforward just because they have quite a few quid in their back pocket. If you're a long, long way from home for 2-3 months on your own, it's not that straightforward. And listen, we've all been out and about in the last few days. He's not the only one who's breaking the odd rule here and there.
No, that is very fair, to be honest. So, but the problem I have with Serge is he's really not helping himself. So the first one, you know, I get your point about he might be very lonely and need to get out, and I have a lot of sympathy for that. The first one, he was caught because he was training with Moussa Sissoko, and that was unfortunate, and he was spotted, and this is the problem with being high profile. And if memory serves, wearing your Tottenham Hotspur training gear in a very public place.
With your initials on it.
Yeah. So second time, that was one, and that might have been a warning to him that, Serge, you know, people don't like when you do this. So then what happened second time was he posted a video of himself. He wasn't actually caught. He just took a video of himself and a friend, not social distancing, right in the height of lockdown. And he said, I'm going to put this video out there and show people how I'm running around. So that didn't go down well. Now, his third effort has been to take to Instagram and to show off his new haircut and to tag in the hairdresser who gave him the haircut and to say, great job. It was great to see you. So that's three strikes. I mean,
Surge. The fact that Tottenham have come out and said that they're investigating this, is there the possibility, I have seen other people doing this online, I don't know my hairdresser well enough, because I just sort of turn up wherever, whenever, to be able to call them, but I have seen other people where a hairdresser is showing them online how to cut their hair.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a possibility that's what happened?
There is.
He was just on a live Zoom call getting advice. I saw some, obviously lots of clubs are back to training yesterday and today, and clubs are going in. And players for individual sessions. There was pictures of Sadio Mane, who most definitely looked like he tried to cut his own hair. Basically, there's now no hair at all in the front half of his forehead, and then a couple of little bits missing here and there as well. So I would worry that Sadio was halfway through, thought the better of it, and maybe forgot that he's one of the most famous footballers in the world and is going to be photographed everywhere he went. Yeah. Come on, Serge. Just stay off social media.
Yeah. We heard about the positive test yesterday, so there were six players or staff, it must be said, tested positive across three clubs. This was of 748 tests. Now, that might sound like quite a lot, but as we made the point yesterday, if you look at Bundesliga 5 weeks ago, where the Premier League are now, they were at 0.58% of positive tests when they tested all their players and staff. This puts the Premier League at 0.8%, so pretty negligible difference, and it allows them to continue it. Some degree of confidence. One of the players who has revealed he is one of the positive tests is Adrian Mariappa at Watford. The interesting thing here, and to be honest, in some respects, maybe encouraging for all of us going forward, if when we start doing zero prevalence tests in a month or two, it turns out more of us have had this horrible thing than we realise, and maybe there is herd immunity of some kind built up. But so he said, ever since I got my positive test back on Tuesday, I've been scratching my head to try and work out how I might have got coronavirus. It was a big surprise. I haven't really left the house, apart from some exercise and the odd walk with the kids. I've been mainly just homeschooling and keeping fit. My lifestyle is very quiet. Certainly no parties, we're looking at you, Kyle Walker, or going out or anything. So I don't really know how I got it. Like most people, we've been having deliveries of food or things. So maybe that's one way, or maybe my partner has been to the supermarket a few times, maybe that's another. But he said he was asymptomatic. He had no idea he had this, was scratching his head. And in some respects, I look at that as quite a positive story. The more Adrian Mariappas we have, who have secretly, unbeknownst to themselves, had this, the better. So that's one of the players, that's one of the six.
Yeah, Ian Wone, the assistant manager at Burnley as well, has been announced as one of the others, and again asymptomatic. Right. I obviously hope for both of them that it doesn't develop into anything over the coming days or next 10 days, 2 weeks. They only have to self-isolate for 7 days before they can return to training.
Right.
And yeah, you're right, but I guess it shows maybe the difference between England where it is right now, Germany where it is, and even in Ireland where you have Tony Houlihan saying we've pretty much squashed the virus within the community, that in England it is obviously still quite prevalent in the community, that maybe it is as simple as Adrian Mariappa's girlfriend going out to the shop and picking it up there. Mm. So there's no way you can really control that. But we did wonder this time last night whether it would become public or whether, because of the privacy and because of understandably people's health, that maybe this wouldn't be released. But most of them are out there now. Mm. Watford about a couple of different cases, which again is interesting going back to 24 hours ago, because they were the one club who had players being quite outspoken about this, that Troy Deeney had said he wasn't going back to training. It seems today a few more players, understandably, if some of your teammates have been diagnosed and have been around, that you may be thinking, you know what, I'm going to take a break for a few days. So it will be interesting to watch over the next few days how this develops at Watford. And again, if there's any more cases and just how comfortable the players are being in there when one of their teammates has been diagnosed, albeit is not going to be around the training ground for the next week. Do they feel comfortable being in there?
Mm. Where are we in League of Ireland? I know we briefly touched on this last night. I saw Dan McDonald the other day making the point that Moldova have set out their plan as well. It means the Republic of Ireland are the only summer league. I think there are about 12 summer leagues across Europe. It's either 12 or 24. I think it's 12 summer leagues. But the League of Ireland, the only one that still doesn't have a plan, and perhaps the only one talking about waiting until 2021. I know Stephen Bradley came out very strongly against that. Are we any closer? Niall Quinn was in the show in the last couple of days.
Yeah, Niall Quinn was on the show at the end of last week. Again, a lot of ideas swirling around. Even today, you see that this four-team tournament with the clubs that will play in Europe now been penciled in potentially for Tallaght Stadium rather than the Aviva Stadium, which would be maybe more realistic in terms of how a league will start with certain stadiums picked at different parts of the country. And Tallaght's obviously one of the most modern of the stadiums in use by League of Ireland clubs at the moment. It does all come down to money. While I can understand the frustration, I saw Gary Rogers tweeting this, the Dundalk goalkeeper, who's very involved in the PFAI. You also have to remember that the League of Ireland is alone in that it receives little or no television revenue. Now, it's not as low as maybe it was put out there in recent years, but even still, clubs won't be able to survive on television revenue alone. They need some other form of income. So it's hard to see how any real progress can be made, despite the plans that are in place. And those four clubs are allowed to go back training, it seems, on the 8th of June. And then hopefully everything goes all right with them and you can get into some sort of a rhythm of getting clubs back. But ultimately, at some stage, we're going to need an answer about who pays for it. Who pays the players' wages?
Yes, because I saw...
Again, there was talk today that Division 1, which has been forgotten in all this, is the first division, that they're talking about Abbottstown potentially hosting the vast majority of Division 1 games, where again there's a lot of facilities, there's a lot of separate changing rooms, and there's a lot of pitches, so teams could all be there at a similar time and not come into contact with each other.
Yeah, that sounds like a very viable solution if that worked. Because I saw Sweden, which after the League of Ireland is the second most reliant on gate receipts, they also have 20 million coming in via TV money, which the League of Ireland certainly does not. And 20 million goes quite a long way, so who makes up that kind of a shortfall? I don't know. Ultimately, given the FAI's 50 million debt as of last December, ultimately it will have to be the government if it's going to go ahead.
Or some more money comes from FIFA somewhere down the track, or from UEFA. But again, I think you've touched on another side of this, which is the FAI's massive debt, that if money is coming into the FAI, how much of that can be put and ring-fenced for the League of Ireland to ensure that their players are paid? You've got to imagine there's going to be all sorts of different entities and groups who want a bit of whatever money comes into the FAI, because there's not going to be a huge amount coming in over the next year, 18 months, by the sounds of the amount of games that are played behind closed doors. So they need to somehow find a way. Again, most clubs aren't on huge wages. And also, everything has complications. So different clubs have different wage bills. Is their full wage bill covered? Certain clubs can get away with their players and the government scheme and getting the €350 a week for as long as that lasts. But is every club going to get their entire wage bill covered? Will it be to do with the certain finances of different clubs? Like, with Vinnie Perth on the show a couple of weeks ago, that, you know, Dundalk are in a decent financial state and that their owners at the moment are committed to paying all their staff. But how long can that last? And also, are they going to be looking around at other clubs then who are getting propped up and getting their wages covered, yet they have to continue to pay the vast majority of their players? So I think there's still there's a huge amount of questions. They need to find the money first, though.
John Giles tomorrow is picking. And my treacherous Anglophile spirit is really excited about this, I have to be honest. I'm every bit as excited about this as any other team he's picked. He is picking his all-time English 11. Now we're talking. Now we are talking. I have the team in front of me. Have you seen the team?
I have. I was on the phone to John for about an hour earlier. So we go. Now, that's the team for now. Thursday is his real thinking day. So in recent weeks, this started off as, I think John thought, this would be a good idea, get us through a couple of weeks, to generally getting a call at 9 a.m. on Thursday morning for John with the first redraft, where he's had to think about it. He's had to look at a few more things. And I think at one stage at 5 to 7, we had one final change one Thursday night. So he's putting a lot of time into this. And yeah, I'm excited about this as well, because, again, once you start going through the list of options and having to pick two or three. So at the moment, he's going to 4-3-3, but that may change. But you look at the attacking options that England have since 1960. So, you know, Jeff Hurst, Roger Hunt, Trevor Francis, Wayne Rooney, Mick Jones, Lineker, Beardsley, Keegan, Barnes, Sheringham, Owen, Shearer, Greaves, Peter Osgood. Trying to pick three of those guys. In midfield, Scholes, Peters, Ball, Stiles, Gazza, Wilkins, Hoddle, Ince, Beckham, Gerrard, Waddle, Lampard, Bobby Charlton.
Yeah.
And again, the genius of this from John Giles' point of view, because there's few people who could do this, is that, you know, he can throw someone like Johnny Haynes into the mix of a shortlist. And how do you compare him with a Steven Gerrard? Yet there was a good 20 minutes on the phone earlier on where he was well able to not just compare Steven Gerrard and Johnny Haynes, but also how Johnny Haynes revolutionised the game as an inside centre, which no longer exists, and how Steven Gerrard's role for Liverpool and for England thoroughly differed from that. So, yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting selection once again. Last week's was just out of this world.
Yeah. I think what you've just done there is called a spoiler. But anyway, he may change by...
I'm not saying who's in or out. Maybe they're both in.
Hey, so I presume in all of these, Bobby Charlton is the first name on the team sheet, the only indisputable that goes in for United and for England.
It seems to be Bobby Charlton, the best player he's played with.
Yeah.
And also, you just throw him in there. He does what he wants. He delivers the goods. You don't tell him what to do. You don't give him a position.
Mm.
He is just the man in the middle of midfield.
That is tomorrow evening, just after 7 o'clock, just after the news round. So that is on the way.
Yep.
Lovely stuff. Nathan, take it easy. We'll talk to you soon.
Mind yourself. The OTB Podcast Network.